last session, she said with some pride. You didn't put me under. I was fully conscious the whole way through. That's fine, Ellen told her. She got that a lot, and often from clients who had just moments ago been drooling and slack-jawed, quite clearly in deep trances. We're going to work on another dial today, Ellen told her. I think we'll call it your good energy dial. Deborah's lips pulled back in a slight sneer. That sounds very cute. I think you're going to like it, said Ellen firmly, ignoring the sneer. Negativity hid fear. She used a quick, simple induction that involved feeling a deeper sense of relaxation with each step taken down a flight of stairs, and watched as Deborah's sharp features relaxed. She looked much younger when she was in a trance, and in spite of her skepticism, Deborah most certainly did go into a trance. The lines on her face smoothed out, and there was a vulnerable, naked look about her, in contrast to her conscious, edgy confidence. It made Ellen feel motherly toward her. I want you to think of a time when you felt filled with confidence or joy, she said. Sift through your memories until you find that one perfect moment. Nod when you're there. Ellen waited and watched, and as she did, she traveled back through time herself to her own perfect moment when she had first practiced hypnosis. She was 11, sitting in this very room with her grandmother, her mother's mother, who believed that everything Ellen did was spectacular. Ellen had just finished reading a book she'd found at the library, How to Hypnotize Anybody, and her grandmother had agreed to be her first patient. She used a necklace as a pendulum and watched her grandmother's shrewd brown eyes follow it, back and forth, back and forth. You're very good at that, her grandmother said afterward, blinking with what Ellen could tell was genuine surprise. It was quite different from her generous clapping after Ellen played her the recorder. I think you might have a gift. I think you might have a gift. The sweetest, most surprising words imaginable. It was like that moment in the movies when superheroes discover their powers. Or perhaps it was how nuns felt when they first heard the spooky, charismatic voice of God whispering in their virginal ears. Deborah, her eyes still shut, her cheeks slightly flushed, nodded to signal she had her moment. Ellen wondered briefly what Deborah was remembering. That feeling you're reliving right now? That's the feeling I want you to be able to call upon whenever you need it. Whenever you press your thumb into your right hand, you can generate that feeling. The harder you press, the more you can increase the feeling until it's flowing like electricity through your body. Ellen let her voice rise with the vigor and power she wanted Deborah to feel. So next time you feel pain, this is what you can do. First, you can use the pain dial to reduce your level of pain. And then you can use your energy dial to recreate that feeling of power. She saw a flicker of hesitancy on Deborah's face and immediately switched to a more authoritative, paternal tone. You have the ability to do this, Deborah. It's all there inside you. You are going to excel at these techniques. You can be pain-free. You can be pain-free. A few minutes later, Ellen brought Deborah out of her trance. She blinked in a disoriented, bleary-eyed way, like a passenger waking up on a plane before quickly checking her watch. Then she ran both her hands through her hair and said, I didn't go under again, and briskly pulled out her wallet from her handbag. Ellen just nodded and offered her the bowl of chocolates, but later as they were standing at the front door and Deborah was putting on her coat, she said slowly, without looking at Ellen, concentrating on doing up her buttons, You know, you might actually cure me. I'm not curing you, Ellen reminded her. The physical cause could still very well be there, whatever it is. I'm just helping you find a way to manage the pain. Yes, but it might actually work, said Deborah, and the surprise and respect in her eyes reminded Ellen of the look on her grandmother's face all those years ago. Ellen smiled now, remembering that moment. That was job satisfaction. She opened her diary, and her smile faded when she saw her last appointment for the day. Mary Kate McGovern. Oh well, no more surprised, respectful looks today. She glanced at her watch. there was still time for Mary-Kate to cancel. On three previous occasions, she had called at the last minute to say that she couldn't get away from work. She was a legal secretary and always sounded full of breathless self-importance when she called to cancel, as though the law firm she worked for couldn't operate without her. Ellen chided herself for that uncharitable thought. Maybe Mary-Kate was indispensable. And she always insisted on paying the 50% cancellation fee that Ellen specified on her price list for cancellations with less than 24 hours notice, even though Ellen never tried to enforce her own policy. She hated the idea of accepting money for doing nothing. The doorbell rang and Ellen swore, as if she'd stubbed her toe. So she was annoyed when Mary-Kate cancelled, and she was annoyed when she turned up. For some reason, she was feeling a strong antipathy toward this poor, sad woman. What was that about? She'd had annoying clients before, and clients she'd liked more than others, but she'd never experienced such a visceral feeling of displeasure when a client turned up for an appointment. If she wasn't careful, her dislike would seep its way into Mary-Kate's therapy, and that would be unconscionable. She reminded herself of the Buddhist doctrine, "We are all one." She was Mary-Kate, and Mary-Kate was her. She opened the door with a warm, welcoming smile. "Mary-Kate, wonderful to see you." "I'm sure it's just glorious to see me," said Mary-Kate with a bright, sarcastic smile. She couldn't have heard Ellen swear, could she? As usual, Mary-Kate was dressed entirely in black. She was a dumpy, lumpy woman with long, lank hair parted in the middle like a 1970s flower child, except that she didn't have the fresh baby face to carry it off. Her face had a resentful, hangdog look. "Oh, you're a depressing sight," thought Ellen. She longed to give her a makeover, to cut her hair off, give it some volume and color, to dress her in some color other than black. Her face was quite pretty, really. Even a touch of lipstick would brighten her up. Good Lord, she was turning into someone's awful mother. "Would you like to use the bathroom?" she asked Mary-Kate. She always asked clients if they wanted to use the toilet first. A full bladder was the worst thing for a good hypnosis session. "No, thank you," said Mary-Kate. "Let's just get on with it." When Mary-Kate was sitting in the green recliner, somehow managing to make it look like the most uncomfortable chair ever, Ellen opened Mary-Kate's file on her lap. "How have you been since we last met?" she asked. "Same as ever, fat as a whale. How have you been?" Ellen glanced up at her. "You're worried about your weight?" "No. Well, yes, of course. Obviously. But whatever." Mary-Kate sighed and yawned. "So, Friday today. Got anything interesting planned for the weekend, Ellen? Seeing friends? Family?" "No particular plans," said Ellen. "So, tell me, is weight loss something you'd like us to work on?" At Mary-Kate's first appointment, she'd said she'd wanted hypnosis because she'd started becoming panicky whenever she drove through the Sydney Harbour Tunnel, and she wanted to put a stop to it before she became one of those nutty, fragile types. She hadn't mentioned anything about her weight, but that was often the case with clients. The real reason they were there didn't emerge until after a few visits. "Perhaps I went through the potato famine in a past life," said Mary-Kate. "And now I'm trying to make up for it. That's why I crave potatoes." "Well, hypnotherapy can be very useful." "I don't believe in past lives," said Mary-Kate truculently. "That's such crap." "I think we talked about this at our last session," said Ellen mildly. She was not fond of the word crap. Also, they had talked at some length about Mary-Kate's lack of belief in past lives. "So you don't take people back to their past lives?" "I don't specifically offer past life regression," began Ellen. "But I certainly have had clients who believe they have re-experienced past lives under hypnosis. I have an open mind about it." Mary-Kate snorted and gave a little sneer. "Have you had to drive through the tunnel since I saw you last?" asked Ellen. Mary-Kate shrugged. "Yeah, I did. I was fine, actually. I must have got over it." Ellen studied her. "So then, what are you hoping to gain from today's session, Mary-Kate?" Mary-Kate sighed again. She looked disdainfully around the room as if it was a cheap hotel room, leaned over, took a chocolate, then changed her mind and dropped it back in the bowl again. Finally, she spoke. "Actually, I think I do need to use your bathroom." It felt like relief to see her again. I don't know how she feels about me, but I sort of like her. I mean, I'm sickened by her existence, obviously, but I find her strangely compelling. It's almost a perverse crush. Like when you meet a man and you find him repulsive, but you still want to go to bed with him. And when you do, it's great, but afterward you feel ill with regret. Like that ape-like guy I met at one of the client Christmas parties last year. He wore too much aftershave and more jewelry than me. The sex was fine, but afterward I was like a rape victim, scrubbing myself in the shower and sobbing for Patrick. I guess it's like that self-loathing you feel after eating bad, greasy junk food. Ellen wouldn't eat junk food. Tofu and lentils, I imagine. I wonder if she's lovingly appalled by Patrick's pizza habit yet. It's not like I want to go to bed with her. I just want to know everything about her. I want to watch her in every imaginable situation. I want to get inside her head and inside her body. I want to be her. Just for a day. I haven't felt like this about any of the other girls Patrick has dated. The thing about Ellen, it makes me feel good that I can use her name. I used it a lot at our last session. Thanks, Ellen. See you next week, Ellen. Each time I use her name, it's like I'm slapping Patrick across his self-satisfied face. Don't think you've moved on, boy. Making a new life that has nothing to do with me? I'm still here. I'm tossing her name about. I've been in her house. I've used her bathroom. I know what brand deodorant and tampons she uses. She's nothing special. Except, maybe she is. She might even be too good for you, buddy. She might be out of your league. Out of our league. The thing about Ellen is that it seems like she is exactly the same person on the outside as she is on the inside. That's the impression she gives anyway, as if she's without artifice or affectation, as if she doesn't have to filter every word that comes out of her mouth to make sure it gives the impression she wants to give. Of course she must have some sort of filter. Everyone has a filter. It's just that her filter is something quick and simple that carefully discards anything that might accidentally offend anyone. Whereas my filter is a labyrinth of pipes and funnels and sieves that converts everything I think into something acceptable to say, depending on the situation and the person and what I'm trying to prove at that particular moment. She has nothing to prove. She really believes all that power of the mind crap. She's passionate about it. It's like her religion. She comes across as a bit sanctimonious at first, but I think she's actually genuinely a good person, in the old-fashioned sense of the word. She wishes only good for the world. Whereas you and I, Patrick, we're sort of flawed. We don't wish everyone well, do we? I feel like such a fake when I'm with her, not just for the obvious reasons. If I met her as my true self, I would still be aware of that difference between us. I can understand why you think you might love her, Patrick. I do understand. I love her a little bit too. It's just that on our first Christmas Eve together, you and I fell asleep flat on our backs like sunbakers. We were holding hands with the taste of raspberries in our mouth from that wonderful liqueur stink he gave us. And the ceiling fan whirled above us, and the room seemed to rock just gently. And I remember thinking it was like we were two children on a raft floating down a magical river. That night happened. I don't care how sweet or pure-hearted Ellen is. That night happened. To us, when she didn't even exist. Remember how we both had a crush on Cameron Diaz? Well, that's how it should be with Ellen. We should have met her at a dinner party, and on the way home we could have talked about how lovely she was, and how interesting and weird all that hypnosis stuff was, and by the time we got home we should have forgotten all about her. She's extremely nice, but she's like Cameron Diaz, Patrick. She's not meant to be a real person in our lives. She's nothing to do with us. Ellen and Patrick were driving to her mother's place. Patrick was behind the wheel. He was the sort of man who automatically assumed it was his job to drive, which was fine with Ellen, who was a nervy driver. She remembered how John always carefully, correctly shared the driving. "Your turn," he'd say, tossing her the keys. Then he'd sigh and snort and criticize her driving the whole way. "So your mother never met anyone else after your dad," said Patrick. "Jesus, this traffic is out of control. He banged his foot on the brake and the car jerked. Sorry. He was clearly nervous. It was such a pity that Ellen couldn't reassure him by saying something like, Oh, my mother's going to adore you. Her mother probably wouldn't adore him. Out of all of Ellen's past relationships, Anne had liked John the best, with his witty, caustic remarks. Of course she had. John was the one who had done the most damage to Ellen's self-esteem, the one she'd loved who hadn't really loved her back. If only she had one of those sweet, slightly plump, chatty mothers who were sort of vague about politics and business and anything outside the domestic realm. If only she had a grey-haired, bespectacled father who would warmly shake Patrick's hand and ask him man-to-man questions about surveying, while the sweet mother fussed about trying to get the fellows to take a second piece of cheesecake. It wasn't going to be like that at all. Mum has had a few long-term relationships over the years, she told Patrick, but not for a while now. And your dad is just not in the picture? Never anywhere near the picture, said Ellen. She paused, aware of a slight flash of irritation. Like I said. She had told him her family history a few weeks after they started dating. She had perfected the telling of the story over the years so that it was the ideal party piece or dinner party anecdote. Unusual and interesting and intimate, just the right length, with no embarrassing emotion likely to cause guests to shift uneasily in their seats. She always started the same way. My mother was a woman ahead of her time. Then she would explain that early on the morning of the 1st of January 1971, the intensely pragmatic Dr. Anne O'Farrell made a New Year's resolution to become a single mother. She was a successful, independent woman in her 30s, and she didn't especially want to be married, but she did, oddly, want a baby. With the help of her two closest female friends, she made a list of potential candidates to father her child, along with their positive and negative attributes, their education levels, their medical histories, and their personality traits. Anne had kept these lists and given them to Ellen when she was a teenager. Her father was a list of bullet points in her mother's scrawly handwriting with the figure 85% circled next to it, the highest score by 10%. Her father's positive attributes included postgraduate education level. He was a surgeon and had met him at the university. Good teeth, small ears. Her mother abhorred large, flappy ears. Excellent skin. No family history of heart disease, diabetes, or respiratory problems, and good social skills. His negative attributes were eyesight, glasses, spiritual tendencies, mother who reads tarot cards, somewhat strange sense of humor, and engaged to be married. Over recent years, Ellen had started leaving off the engaged to be married part when she told people about the list. She didn't know if it was the whole world that was becoming more moral, a sort of increasing level of global prudishness, or if it was just her own social circle that appeared to be becoming more conservative. Apparently, her father's engagement hadn't been an obstacle. It had been as easy as pie to seduce him, not just once, but the optimum number of times and on the appropriate days before and after ovulation. It was the 70s, after all, said her mother. And that was that. A job well done. Her father got married 2 months later and went off to live in the UK and never knew of Ellen's existence. What if I wanted to go and find my dad? She'd said to her mother when she was going through her extremely tame, short-lived, rebellious teenager stage, and she quivered a little at the unfamiliar, almost sexual word in her mouth. Dad. I'm not stopping you. Anne didn't even look up from the newspaper she was reading. It would be a very cruel, hurtful thing to do to his wife. And of course, Ellen would never knowingly do anything cruel or hurtful, and besides, the thought of actually meeting this middle-aged man filled her with shyness. Her friends' fathers were big and hairy and deep-voiced, sometimes funny but mostly boring and somehow essentially irrelevant to real life. Her mother's friends, Melanie and Philippa, had never had children of their own. They had been Ellen's godmothers, and for much of Ellen's childhood had shared a house with her mother. There had been various boyfriends who arrived to take them out on dates, who sometimes turned up at breakfast time, unshaven and croaky-voiced at the kitchen table. But mostly they were just an amusing sideshow in Ellen's life. Their mannerisms and appearances were dissected with much hilarity before they vanished. Although Mel had finally got married in her 50s to a shy, inscrutable man who seemed to make her very happy and didn't overly impact on her social life. It was like having three mothers, Ellen would tell people, which was true. Three successful, opinionated, single women who all had an equal say in her upbringing. It was like growing up in a lesbian commune, she'd continue, but she'd stop saying that as she got older because she'd just been trying to sound sophisticated and edgy. And maybe it was a bit disrespectful to lesbians, and she actually had no idea what it would be like to live in a lesbian commune, or even if they existed. So my father was basically a sperm donor. He just didn't know it. That's how she always finished the story, and it normally generated lots of stimulating discussion, and people would say things like, "Aha, that's where you get your hypnotism thing from, your spiritual dad and your tarot card reading grandma." As if they were the first people in the world to have thought of that. And some would applaud her mother's actions, and others would politely, or not so politely, express their disapproval. She didn't mind when people disapproved. She wasn't sure if she approved herself. But she knew her mother couldn't care less what anyone else thought, and Ellen had told the story of her conception so many times now, she felt quite detached from it. It was like Julia's story of how her father had kidnapped her and her brother during a bitter custody dispute between her parents and dyed their hair brown, and there had even been a thrilling police chase. Ellen knew that Julia must have once felt some sort of emotion about this memory, and probably at some subconscious level she still did. But now it was just an excellent story, a party piece. Patrick had listened to her story carefully, and at the end he'd said, "Good for your mum. But I'm sorry you missed out on having a father." "You don't miss what you don't have," said Ellen, which wasn't something she really believed at all, but she certainly hadn't spent her childhood sobbing into her pillow for daddy. "Maybe it would have been different if I'd been a boy. I think daughters still need their dads," Patrick had said gravely, and his seriousness made her fall a bit further in love with him and imagine him tenderly holding a baby girl. Yes, all right, her own baby girl, like a man in a baby powder commercial. And now he was saying, "And your dad wasn't ever in the picture?" As if he hadn't really concentrated on the story properly, as if he'd heard her story at a dinner party many years ago and couldn't quite remember the details. It was so disappointing. Ellen felt that nauseous, anxious feeling again. What if she just wanted to be madly in love with this man? What if it was all a gigantic self-delusion? What if he was actually a superficial, selfish prat? Would she have been better equipped to pick out the good men if she'd grown up with a father? Probably. In fact, almost definitely. After her mother had called her bluff about contacting her father, she'd researched the psychology of fatherless daughters and left photocopies around the house for her mother to find, with particularly damning sections marked in yellow highlighter. "What exactly do you want me to do about this?" her mother had said. "Go back in time and never conceive you?" "Feel guilty," Ellen had answered. Anne had laughed. Guilt wasn't in her emotional lexicon. "I'm sorry," said Patrick as the light changed to green and the car inched farther forward. "I know your dad wasn't in the picture. I'm just nervous. I've got that job interview feeling. I'm not great at job interviews, especially when I badly want the job." She glanced over at him and caught an expression of almost terrified vulnerability cross his face. For an instant, he looked exactly like his son. "When I'm nervous, I just start coming out with all this crap that doesn't even make sense." He frowned as he looked in the rear vision mirror. "Also, I'm sort of distracted because our friend is back."
"Friend?" said Ellen.
"Our bunny boiler friend, behind us."
"Saskia is following us again?"
Ellen swung around in her seat and scanned the cars behind them.
"Which one is she?"
"Yeah, that's great. That's fantastic. That's one thing you really need, your ex following you to meet your girlfriend's family for the first time," muttered Patrick.
"Yes, but where is she?"
The seatbelt pulled hard across Ellen's neck. Directly behind them was a man in a truck, his eyes closed, thumping his hands against the big steering wheel, his mouth moving as he sang along to an unheard song. "She's in the lane next to us, a couple of cars back," said Patrick. "Don't worry, I'm going to lose her." He slammed his foot down on the accelerator and the car shot forward. Ellen turned around in time to see the lights change from orange to red. When she looked back, they were crossing the intersection, leaving a bank of stationary cars at the lights.
What colour? She said desperately. What colour car?
Lost her, said Patrick happily. Look, we're moving again.
Great, said Ellen, and rubbed at her sore neck. I lost them at the lights, and I couldn't guess which way they were going. Maybe they were meeting up with friends of hers. Patrick doesn't know anyone down that way. I saw her turning around in her seat. I wonder if she was trying to see me. Patrick probably knew I was behind. I know when he knows I'm behind him. He drives faster than usual, erratically. Sometimes he sticks his finger up at me. Once I saw him getting a ticket for doing an illegal right-hand turn trying to get away from me. I felt bad about that because he'd always been proud of the fact that he'd never got a ticket in over 20 years of driving. I sent him a bottle of wine to his work to apologize. I picked it out especially. A pepper tree white. We discovered that wine on a trip to the Hunter Valley during our last summer together. We bought a whole case and we got addicted to it. I don't see how he could drink that wine without thinking of me. But I waited outside his office that night, and I saw one of the girls he worked with walking to her car carrying my bottle of wine. I recognized it because I'd wrapped it up in blue tissue paper. He didn't even bother to open it. He just handed it to that girl. I try to imagine how he describes me to the hypnotist. To Ellen. I guess he tells her I'm psychotic. He yelled that at me once. I was walking behind him at his local shops when he suddenly swung around and walked straight back toward me. I stopped and waited for him, smiling. He was smiling too. I thought we were finally going to have a proper conversation. But then, when he got closer, I saw it was a sarcastic, angry smile. He stuck his finger in my face and yelled, "You're a psychotic lunatic!" Which, you know, might have been funny in other circumstances, except that I was worried he was going to hit me. He was so angry he was shaking. Actually, I sort of longed for him to hit me. I needed him to hit me. If he wasn't ever going to hold me in his arms again, at least he could hit me. There would be a connection once more, flesh against flesh. But he didn't. He locked his hands behind his neck and rocked his head like an autistic child. I just wanted to comfort him. He didn't need to get so worked up. It was only me. I'm still only me. That's what he can't seem to get. I said, "Darling." He dropped his hands, and I saw that his eyes were red and watery. He said, "Don't call me that," and he walked away. And I stayed where I was, looking at the specials pinned up on the window of the shop where we always got fish and chips on a Sunday night. That's the thing. I'm permanently stuck in this crazy person role now. He will always think of me as a crazy person. He used to think I was a funny bugger and I had beautiful eyes and that I was one of the most generous people he'd ever met. Those were all things he said to me, things he meant at the time. But now I'm just crazy. The only way for me to not be crazy would be to disappear from his life, like a proper ex-girlfriend is expected to do, to discreetly vanish into the past. And that's what drives me crazy. Ellen could see Patrick's fight-or-flight response kick in as soon as they walked across the doorway of her mother's home. Oh, my poor darling, she thought. She remembered the first time she'd taken John to meet her mother, the way he'd looked about with those lazy, hooded eyes, so certain of his own superiority. Patrick's clear green eyes were darting about as if looking for possible escape routes, and he was clearing his throat over and over. It mattered to him what Ellen's mother thought. It mattered, and that meant Ellen mattered. Poor man. It was understandable that he was nervous. John was an exception. Most men would find this intimidating. Three immensely elegant, immensely confident women in their 60s, all holding the delicate stems of their wine glasses with their fingertips, all bizarrely dressed almost entirely in white, to complement her mother's all-white theme, white couches, white walls, white accessories, all swooping down from the high stools on which they'd been perched to kiss Patrick on both cheeks. And Patrick, who only expected to be kissed on one cheek and kept offering the wrong one, having to bend awkwardly at the knees so they could reach him. "Why are you all dressed in white?" asked Ellen. "You're blending into the furniture." There were peals of laughter. "We couldn't believe it when we saw each other," gurgled Pip. We look like that Bette Midler movie, First Wives Club. Not that we've ever been wives. Ellen watched her mother's eyes rest on Patrick's tradesman out on the town outfit of blue jeans and long-sleeved Just Jeans check shirt rolled to the elbows. John wore Armani and Versace and some other Italian men's designer label that was so very special Ellen had never heard of it.
Ah, Anne, Mel is a wife, pointed out Pip.
Oh, of course she is. I just never think of her as one. Which is a compliment, Mel. I'm so flattered, Anne.
Who else was in that movie? Mused Pip. Bette Midler, Goldie Hawn, and somebody else. Someone I like. Do you know Patrick?
Patrick looked startled. I'm not... We finally worked out it was because we'd all read the same article in Vogue, said Mel. About flattering colours for women in their 50s. Not that we're technically in our 50s.
Speak for yourself, said Anne.
Ellen's mother found it genuinely insulting to be reminded of her actual age. You're 34 days older than me, Anne O'Farrell.
Diane Keaton, cried Pip. That was the third wife. Thank goodness I got it. That was going to drive me crazy for the whole night. Patrick, what can we get you? Beer, wine, champagne, spirits? You sound very dry.
Ellen's mother flicked her hand at the sideboard containing a selection of drinks on ice, while keeping her violet eyes upon Patrick like a bird on its prey. Anne's eyes were her most striking feature. Her friends had wanted her to enter an Elizabeth Taylor lookalike competition when she was young, and she probably would have won if she hadn't thought such competitions beneath her. Unfortunately, she hadn't seen fit to pass on her beautiful eyes to Ellen. Obviously, this wasn't really her decision, except that Ellen had always suspected that if her mother did have the choice, she might have decided to keep all the glory for herself. She was very vain about her eyes. Patrick cleared his throat again. A beer would be great, thanks. You haven't actually introduced us properly yet, Ellen. The poor man probably thinks he's stumbled into some sort of elderly harem. You haven't stopped talking, said Ellen. She put her hand on Patrick's arm. Patrick, this is my mother, Anne. Can you see the resemblance? Anne fluttered her eyelashes up at him as she handed Patrick a glass of beer.
I'm not sure.
Patrick clutched his hand around his beer.
And my godmothers, Mel and Pip,
continued Ellen, ignoring her mother.
Or are you Philippa tonight? She switches back and forth. Depending on whether I'm skinny or fat, said Philippa.
She beamed at Patrick and waved a hand up and down her plump body.
So it's perfectly obvious who I am right now, hey?
An expression of pure panic flew across Patrick's face.
Philippa, remonstrated Ellen. Aha! So, not thin enough for Pip. I have to come back to you for some more hypnotherapy sessions, Ellen.
Philippa turned to Patrick with a deadly serious expression on her face.
I suffer the most debilitating addiction to carbohydrates.
That's... began Patrick. He obviously had no idea how to finish the sentence and drank his beer as if his life depended on it.
I've tried to get Ellen to hypnotize my addiction away.
She giggles the whole way through, sighed Ellen, as her mother passed her a glass of white wine without asking what she wanted. She would have preferred a juice.
Come and have a sensible conversation with me, Patrick, said Melanie.
She patted the stool next to her. Ellen said you're a surveyor, right?
My grandfather had a wonderful collection of old maps he left to me. I think the oldest dates back to about 1820.
Patrick took his beer glass away from his lips and spoke in his normal voice.
Is that right?
Mel got Patrick settled next to her and pushed a plate of bread and salmon dip toward him. Ellen watched Patrick's shoulders relax as Mel chatted calmly to him, steering him onto stable, factual, masculine conversational ground where he could be sure of his footing. She always thought that Mel should have been a diplomat's wife because of her ability to talk graciously and knowledgeably on any subject. Although Mel herself would have found that a very sexist remark.
I'd be the diplomat, thanks very much, she would have said.
Let's go help your mother,
Philippa grabbed Ellen by the arm.
Why, how kind of you, Pip, said Anne, her violet eyes still on Patrick. Oh, darling, he's just adorable, said Philippa, as soon as they were in Anne's pristine kitchen. I bet he's one of those strong, silent types, isn't he? I can just see him on a mountaintop with his surveying equipment squinting into the sun.
No, said Ellen, although that was exactly the way she liked to imagine him.
He's not like that at all. He's very chatty when he gets the chance to be, and he mostly does surveys on houses.
Oh, to be young and in love, said Philippa nostalgically. I loved being in love. I always lost so much weight.
I remember you sitting in this kitchen and saying, oh, to be young and in love to Julia and me when we were 17, said Ellen. She paused.
And that means you weren't that much older than me now.
Speaking of Julia, said her mother, who never required anyone's help and was now giving the last-minute touches to delicately constructed meals on giant square white plates that would be divinely flavored but would no doubt leave Patrick suggesting pizza on the way home and Philippa reaching for the breadbasket.
I saw Julia's mother at yoga on Saturday. She said your new boyfriend has a stalker.
The grapevine is so efficient, said Ellen. It sometimes felt like she'd never left that closed little private school world of her school days, where all her friends' mothers were on the same committees.
A stalker? Philippa's eyes popped. How exciting!
Oh, yes, it will all be very exciting, Pip, when my daughter is found dead in a ditch. Anne spoke from inside her walk-in pantry.
Is it an ex-lover? Continued Philippa, ignoring Anne. A woman he spurned? Or just a random homicidal maniac who has taken an interest in him?
Anne came out of the pantry and put a bottle of vinaigrette down on the benchtop with unnecessary force.
Has this person shown any violent tendencies? She asked. Has Patrick reported her to the police?
It's just an ex-girlfriend who hasn't quite moved on, said Ellen. There's really nothing to worry about. She wondered how her mother would react if she knew Saskia had been following them tonight, or if she knew that Ellen had felt a discernible sense of disappointment when they lost her at the lights. Anne said,
Just promise me you'll be careful. You always see the good in people, Ellen, which is all very adorable, but also naive.
Ellen smiled at her.
I must get that adorable tendency from my father.
Anne didn't smile back.
You certainly didn't get it from me.
Too right, said Philippa, and giggled so hard she snorted.
I couldn't decide where to wait for them, Patrick's place or hers. I knew it would depend on what they were doing with Jack for the night. Mostly, Patrick's mum seems to go over to his place and mind Jack. But sometimes Jack goes to her place, and I guess he stays in their spare room. It's not very fair to Maureen. I remember she used to get exhausted when we left him with her as a toddler. He had her wrapped around his little finger. Although, of course, it would be different now that he's 8. I guess he probably just does his own thing, watches TV or whatever. I hope Patrick doesn't let him watch too much TV. I hope he reads. He used to love his books. I remember once I decided to see how many times I could read him The Very Hungry Caterpillar before he got sick of it. I had to give up after I'd read it to him 15 times. Every time I finished, he'd say, Again? With the same enthusiasm. I can still see his little fat, flushed cheeks as he sat there on my lap, in his red Thomas the Tank Engine pajamas, his lips pursed in concentration as he poked his fingers through the holes where the caterpillar had bitten through the apples. I could have babysat Jack tonight while Patrick and Ellen went wherever they went. That would have been fine. Bye, I could have said cheerily, like a teenage babysitter snuggled up on the couch with Jack under a duvet, sharing a bag of chips. Maybe I should text Patrick an offer. Ha ha. I could have been babysitting for years. I sometimes think that would have made all the difference. If Patrick hadn't decided to rip Jack out of my life, my little boy, my darling little boy. I remember one of the mothers I knew from Jack's preschool ringing me up when she heard and saying, He can't do this to you, Saskia. It's got to be illegal. You must have rights. You're Jack's mother. Except I wasn't. His real mother, just his dad's girlfriend. What court would care about that? A relationship that lasted 3 years. I didn't even officially live with him for the first year. Not all that long. Long enough to see him get out of nappies, learn to swim and tell knock-knock jokes and use a knife and fork. Long enough for his hair to go from curly to straight. Long enough for him to call for me whenever he had a bad dream. Me, not Daddy, he always called for me. A sudden shriek slicing through my sleep and I'd be halfway down the hallway before I even woke up properly. I remember once I went to him and he was sitting up in bed, rubbing his eyes and sobbing his heart out. I just wanted to blow out the candles,
he said to me. And I said, "It's okay. You can blow them out," and held out an imaginary cake. He puffed out his cheeks and blew, and that was it. Problem solved. He smiled at me with his eyes still full of tears, and then put his head back on the pillow and fell straight asleep. Patrick didn't know anything about it until the next day. I guess Jack's nightmares aren't so sweet and simple these days. This is the thing. When do you cross the line from babysitter to mother? If you look after a child for a night, you obviously don't suddenly become his mother just because you bathed him and fed him for a few hours. The same goes for a week or a month. But what about after a year, 2 years, 3 years? Is there some point where you cross an invisible line, or is there no line except the legal one, the one you sign on the adoption papers? Foster children can be claimed back by their real parents at any time, even after years. I should have adopted Jack. That was my mistake. But it never even occurred to me. I saw looking after Jack as a privilege, a gift. It was just another wonderful part of being in a relationship with Patrick. So when he broke up with me, I knew that I'd have to lose Jack like I'd have to lose everything else that I loved about Patrick. Like the veiny tops of his hands. I loved his hands. And his handwriting. He had such beautiful handwriting for a man. And the particular way he smiled at me after sex. And his singing. He sang country music songs quietly to himself when he did stuff around the house. I hate country music, but I loved hearing that quiet singing. It was the soundtrack to my life. I never found out if I did have rights to Jack. Maybe I did. But I went into shock when Patrick said he didn't love me anymore. I couldn't get out of bed. I couldn't talk. Couldn't eat. It was like I'd been hit with a terrible illness. It was like a bomb had exploded through my life, shattering everything I thought I knew. If Patrick had just let me see Jack on weekends, like a divorced dad, that might have been enough. Maybe then I wouldn't be doing this thing, this whatever it is, that I cannot seem to stop doing no matter how hard I try. And I have tried. I have. I never understood alcoholics or gambling addicts before. Just stop it, I always thought when I heard about somebody wrecking their life because of a stupid addiction. But now, I get it. It's like telling someone to stop breathing. Just stop breathing and you'll get your life back on track. So you hold your breath for as long as you can, but it doesn't take long before you're gasping for air. I know it's humiliating. I know I'm pathetic. I don't care. It's just not physically possible to stop. And so I sat there in my car outside Ellen's house. She told me her grandmother left it to her when she died, which sort of sums up the differences between us. My grandmother left me a fruit bowl. I had the window down and I could hear the sounds of the waves breaking on the beach. That's what Ellen must hear when she goes to sleep. That's what Patrick must hear when he stays over. I fell asleep, eventually, and when I awoke my back had seized up and the sun was rising and I couldn't see Patrick's car. So that meant they'd stayed at his place. I thought of them asleep in the bed that was once mine, probably lying on the sheets that I'd chosen. And I wondered if he was reaching out for her now in the dawn light, running a fingertip so delicately down her arm she wasn't sure if she was dreaming it. Dreamy, half-asleep lovemaking at dawn was his thing. I opened the car door and got out all hunched over like an old lady. The kookaburras laughed like crazy. Chapter 7. Remember, all hypnosis is self-hypnosis. You can't get stuck in hypnosis. You are always in control. You can stop at any time. Hypnosis is a natural state of mind. Help yourself to the chocolates. Laminated cards stuck to Ellen O'Farrell's office wall. Ellen woke to the feel of Patrick's fingertip running slowly, delicately up the length of her arm. The fingertip on the arm was always his opening move. John used to kiss the back of her neck, tiny butterfly kisses. Edward would lick her earlobe, enthusiastically and wetly, which tickled unbearably. He mistook her shrieks and convulsions for crazy sexual excitement, and she never got around to clearing up the misunderstanding.
Andy would whisper in her ear, his breath hot and irritating. You feel like... What? She always wanted to say. I feel like what? Finish the sentence. She wondered if John was kissing the back of someone's neck right now, and if Edward was licking an earlobe and Andy was whispering his unfinished question. Why are you thinking about ex-lovers? With her eyes still closed, she rolled toward Patrick to give him easy access to her arm. She liked the fingertip thing. She loved the fingertip thing. She'd loved John's butterfly kisses, too. So what? Concentrate on the fingertip. Presumably Patrick had used the same techniques on Saskia in this very same bed, possibly on these very same sheets. Which was interesting, but not at all relevant. Once you'd perfected your sexual moves, you didn't tend to change them. She herself still kissed exactly the same way that boy in the caravan park had taught her to kiss when she was 15. He tasted of beer. Disgusting and delicious. What was that boy's name? Chris? Craig? Something like that. Patrick tugged at her nightie. Let's get this off. She wanted to be in bed with Patrick right now. There was nowhere else she wanted to be. On the other hand, it didn't especially please her, the idea of John kissing someone else's neck. She helped Patrick pull the nightie off over her head. She wondered what Saskia was doing right now. Where did she go last night after she lost them at the lights? Did she go home and look at old photos of herself and Patrick? Did she cry? Was Ellen responsible for another woman's pain? Should she give him back? Of course she had no intention of giving him back. He didn't want Saskia. He wanted Ellen. This was the way the world worked. Relationships ended. If they didn't, she'd still be with beery, breathed boy in the caravan park. Julia was right. Saskia needed to be a grown-up and move on. But on the other hand, wasn't there something noble about Saskia's refusal to let go? She was crazy with passion. Ellen had never let passion make her do anything crazy. What are you thinking about? Patrick was up on his elbow, looking down at her, smiling. He brushed back her hair from her forehead. Saskia, she answered honestly without thinking. Patrick retracted his hand. I cannot get away from that woman, can I? I'm sorry, said Ellen. She went to pull him back toward her, but his lips had compressed into a thin line, and he looked like a grumpy schoolteacher who had just about had it up to here with you kids. He said, Now the bitch is in bed with us. He got out of bed and walked into the ensuite bathroom, closing the door behind him unnecessarily hard. Ellen settled herself back on her pillow and gazed up at the slowly whirling ceiling fan. Around and around and around. She saved it up as a good image for an induction. Imagine you're watching a ceiling fan. Look, Saskia, you stopped us from having sex. He's angry with me because of you. Every time she was with Patrick, part of her was imagining how Saskia would react if she was there, watching. It was like she was performing in her own reality TV show with an audience of just one. If Patrick knew how much time she was devoting to thinking about Saskia, he'd be furious. Outside the window, the kookaburras burbled with laughter. If you stare at someone for long enough from behind, they will sense your gaze and turn around. They don't actually see you, but they feel something different in the atmosphere. That's why I've always believed that if I thought about Patrick for long enough and hard enough, he would sense it. If someone can feel a gaze across a room, then shouldn't they be able to sense a torrent of true emotion, a tsunami of feeling from across a handful of suburbs? I imagine my feelings like a dense cloud floating above the streets of Sydney, and one day Patrick is standing in the shower. He likes his showers long and hot, steam billowing, with the window open, and all of a sudden he senses it. My love. He's breathing in the cloud of my feelings. And he turns off the taps and thinks, Saskia. And while he's drying himself, he thinks, I made a mistake. And then, before he even gets dressed, he calls me. And everything is right again. People get back together. It happens all the time. Why shouldn't it happen to us? Ellen could hear the sound of Patrick's shower running. She must have upset him. He'd been looking forward to this morning. Jack had stayed with his grandparents, and Patrick wasn't picking him up until they went there tonight for dinner. He'd talked about how they would sleep until late this morning and eat breakfast and read the papers in bed. He bought croissants especially. Now she'd ruined his morning. Was it any wonder that the poor man didn't want to hear his stalker's name mentioned when he was trying to make love to Ellen? Overcome with remorse, she threw back the covers. Without putting her nightie back on, she got out of bed and tried the bathroom door. It wasn't locked. The shower was pounding. There was so much steam she could hardly see. "Are you going to join me?" said Patrick from the shower. He didn't sound like an angry schoolteacher anymore. She pulled back the screen. A few minutes later, her legs were locked around Patrick's waist, and she wasn't thinking about Saskia at all.
I wandered around for a while in the hypnotist's front garden. I picked a daisy and stuck it behind my ear, as if I was that sort of girl, the sort who knows she will look whimsical and pretty with a flower stuck behind her ear. It was like I thought the daisy could transform the whole situation, make me cute and endearing, as if this was a funny little love triangle, as if Ellen and I were two girls at a party trying to get the attention of the same boy. Then I walked onto Ellen's front porch and caught sight of my own reflection in the glass panel next to her front door. I looked middle-aged and seedy. I took the flower out and crushed it in the palm of my hand, and then I knocked quite loudly on the front door, even though I knew she wasn't home. I knocked again, angrily. I seemed to be making some sort of point. "I'm here!" Then I shrugged as if we'd had an appointment and she'd let me down. I stepped off the porch and noticed a path running straight down the side of the house and onto the beach. I went down it and took my shoes off and walked barefoot on the cold sand. Imagine that. Walk out your back door and you're on the beach. I wonder if she appreciates it. She doesn't seem like a particularly sporty type. I can't imagine her sweating or puffing. I guess she sits cross-legged and meditates and chants. Or she does yoga, salutes the sun and all that crap. The beach was deserted and silent, except for the lap of the waves and the occasional squawk of a seagull. Still too early for the joggers and power walkers and dog walkers. It was high tide and the pearly sky seemed to hang very low. Without stopping to think about it, I took off all my clothes and ran out into the ocean and dived straight under a wave. The water was so shockingly cold, it made all the air rush out of my lungs. When I came back up, I screamed out loud and dived under again and again. I opened my eyes each time I went under and I saw swirling eddies of sand and shafts of filmy light. Forget him! Let him go! Be free of him! The words came to my head crystal clear each time I went under, as if mermaids were whispering messages in my ear. Afterward, as I walked naked along the beach toward my clothes, with the early morning sun gently caressing my shoulders, I decided to have coffee and read the paper at one of the cafes. Suddenly I felt a strange feeling that I hadn't felt in a long time, and it took me a few minutes to work out that it was happiness. Plain, simple happiness. I'd forgotten how much I like swimming in the sea. It's been ages. The weather had to be scorching and the water had to be practically tepid for Patrick to swim. "You wuss," I used to yell at him from the water, and he'd lift a hand in ironic acknowledgement without even looking up from the paper. His mother told me once that he'd always been funny about water temperature. She had to write him notes to get him out of school carnivals. When he was in the shower, his brother used to throw cups of cold water over him, and he'd scream like a girl. "Big girl's blouse," his dad would say. I wondered if the hypnotist has met his parents yet. His mum was fond of me. One Christmas, after she'd drunk too much punch, she told me that I was like a daughter to her. I might listen to the mermaids and have a night off from Patrick and the hypnotist. I might go to that work party tonight after all. I might wear the red dress I keep putting off wearing. And on the way there, I might drop by on Patrick's mum, just to say hi. I could show her that I've moved on.
"So you're a hypnotist, Ellen," said Patrick's mother. "I must admit, I've never met a hypnotist before."
"She's a hypnotherapist, Mum," Patrick corrected her.
"Oh, I'm sorry."
His mother looked stricken. "It's all right," both Patrick and Ellen rushed to reassure her. Maureen Scott was an off-the-shelf mum and grandma. She had the nondescript, colourless hairstyle, the softly sagging face, the formless figure, the pastel-coloured, elastic-waisted clothes. "My mum is a lot older than yours.
Patrick had said when they were driving over. She's a different generation.
How old is she? Ellen had asked.
She's turning 70 this year.
Ellen's mother was 66, only 4 years younger, but Ellen hadn't pointed it out, and now she was glad.
Maureen did seem as if she was at least 20 years older than Anne. Whereas Ellen's mother was all sharp lines and angles, Maureen seemed without definition. She could imagine Maureen as one of Anne's patients. Anne would be brisk and condescending and tell her to take calcium to avoid osteoporosis and have regular mammograms, as if these old lady problems were a long way in front of her.
So, a hypnotherapist, repeated Maureen carefully. Now, I'm just so interested to hear more about this, Ellen.
She passed Ellen a tray with a picture of the Sydney Harbour Bridge containing a dish of French onion dip and rows of Jats biscuits.
We'll have to watch ourselves, said Patrick's dad. She might hypnotise us over dinner.
He clapped his hands and chuckled. George looked disconcertingly, comically similar to Patrick. Ellen had to stop herself from staring. She didn't think she'd ever seen a parent and child who looked so alike. If Patrick hadn't been in the same room, she might have suspected he was playing a joke on her and pretending to be an old man with a not especially convincing disguise. George's hair was white instead of brown, but seemed to be cut in an identical style, and Patrick's eyes looked out at her from a more wrinkled face. Everything was the same. The shape of his nose, the jawline, the set of the shoulders, even the way they sat in their chairs, cradling glasses of beer in big hands. Their legs stuck out straight in front of them.
They're actually clones, said Patrick's brother in her ear as he reached down beside her to place a coaster in front of her. The coaster had a picture of Ayers Rock on it. Patrick's younger brother Simon was small and dark with a neatly trimmed goatee like a fashion designer. He was only 24 and looked to Ellen like he should have been taking drugs in a nightclub instead of passing around drinks in this red brick bungalow with the crucifix hanging above the television that was silently playing a game show and the china cabinets stuffed with knick-knacks and collector plates.
Ellen is going to teach me how to hypnotize my friends, said Jack without looking up from his spot in front of the television where he was lying on his stomach and playing with a small computer game.
I can teach you, mate, said George.
He picked up a teaspoon and let it swing back and forth between his fingertips.
You're getting sleepier.
He slapped his knee. He was one of those self-applauders.
Yeah, right, Grandpa, said Jack.
I bet Ellen's never heard that joke before, said Simon.
George, said Maureen, I'm sure there's more to hypnotizing people than that.
She looked anxiously at Ellen.
That is there?
A little bit. Ellen smiled. The French onion dip was made from sour cream mixed together with a packet of dried French onion soup. It took her right back to her school days.
Sometimes I feel I've been hypnotized after I've been watching too much television, said Maureen. I feel like I'm coming out of a daze.
Well, that actually is a form of hypnosis, said Ellen.
Is it really?
Said Maureen, looking gratified.
Ellen helps people give up smoking or lose weight, announced Patrick. Things like that. She helps high-powered business executives overcome their fear of public speaking.
He was quoting verbatim from one of Ellen's brochures. She hadn't even known he'd read it. She felt like their relationship had reached a new level today. A deeper, more complex, more profound level. Their lovemaking in the shower this morning had been so extraordinary she kept wanting to tell people about it. The man at the fruit and veg shop had said chattily, "What have you been up to today?" And she wanted to say, well, actually, I had a particularly enjoyable sexual experience in the shower this morning. Thanks for asking. Afterward, they got back into bed and talked, and Patrick had apologized for snapping at her and said that Saskia made him feel so crazy at times that he'd even thought about counseling.
So you help people with public speaking. I've had to do talks in front of clients for work, said Simon, who was a website designer.
I always think I'm not nervous at all, but then this weird thing happens. He stood up to demonstrate. It's like an involuntary spasm in my left leg. He made one knee knock against the other one.
Ha, said Patrick, the same thing happens to me.
Except for me, it's more like this. He stood up and made his leg twitch.
You boys look like Elvis impersonators, chortled Maureen.
Jack had rolled over onto his back to watch.
I'm great at doing speeches,
he said.
That doesn't happen to me. Does it happen to you, Grandpa?
George shook his head. Nope. You must get your nerves of steel from me.
Nerves of steel, murmured Jack to himself. I have nerves of steel.
What about you, Maureen? Said Ellen.
Actually, I'm rather good at speeches, said Maureen unexpectedly. I've been doing the speech at our tennis club Christmas party for over 40 years. It normally goes down quite well.
Mum tells a good joke, said Patrick, sitting back down and picking up his drink. Most mothers are hopeless at telling jokes, said Simon. Not ours. Both men looked proudly at their mother. Maureen beamed. Sometimes they're pretty dirty, said George. My wife tells a good dirty joke.
Oh, I do not, giggled Maureen.
I've got a joke. Knock, knock, cried Jack.
There was a knock on the door. Everyone laughed.
I haven't said the punchline yet, said Jack, offended. Someone knocked when you said knock, knock, explained Maureen. We were laughing at the coincidence. I wonder who that could be. I'm not expecting anyone.
Are you boys expecting someone?
Probably some door-to-door salesman, said Patrick. Bet they'll try to get you to change phone companies.
Well, I just don't know, said Maureen without moving, as if they really needed to work this puzzle out first.
Might be one of those Jehovah fellows.
George didn't move either. The person knocked again.
I just can't think of anyone who would visit at this time, mused Maureen. It's such a funny time, just before dinner.
Man, this is the craziest thing that has ever happened to us, said Simon with such authentic astonishment that Ellen thought at first he was serious. This is life on the edge. This is...
I'm going to answer the door. Patrick put his hands on his knees.
I'll get it!
Jack leapt to his feet and ran out of the room. There was the sound of the door opening and then the unintelligible sound of a woman's voice.
Probably some beautiful woman desperately trying to track me down, said Simon behind his hand to Ellen.
Happens a lot.
Happens a lot in his dreams, said Patrick. They could hear Jack talking at length. I think he's telling the mystery visitor the knock-knock joke, said Simon, grinning.
Well, I suppose I really should, but I just can't think who it would be.
Maureen left the room, patting down her hair. They heard the sound of a woman laughing, and suddenly Patrick banged his drink down so hard on the coffee table that beer sloshed over the side.
You're kidding me!
Kidding you about what?
Said his father. Patrick stood up and pulled back the curtain of the window that looked out onto the street. He shook his head with a nasty, bitter smile, dropped the curtain, and went striding from the room without looking at Ellen. Ellen felt her heartbeat pick up. Patrick had spent the drive over with one eye in the rear vision mirror.
No sign of Bunny Boiler, he'd said happily as they pulled up in front of his parents' house.
What's going on?
Said Patrick's father. I think you know who has stopped by, said Simon. He gave Ellen a rueful, curious look.
Bloody hell, said George. I better go see if they need my help refereeing.
I guess you know about her, said Simon carefully when they were alone in the room.
About his ex-girlfriend.
Yes, said Ellen. She was pressing her hands to her thighs to stop herself from leaping out of her chair to run to the door.
I just want to see what she looks like.
She strained to hear what was going on. Simon shook his head.
Must be a bit weird, upsetting for you.
Oh, not really, said Ellen. I've never even seen her.
She tried not to make it sound like a complaint. Patrick's voice carried loud and clear into the room. Ellen had never heard him speak like that, his voice so rough-edged and unpleasant. He sounded like a big, beefy, red-faced man holding his palm up to the camera on one of those early evening current affairs shows.
Saskia, if you don't leave now, I'm calling the police. You've crossed the line. This is unacceptable.
And then Jack's voice, high with fear or excitement.
Daddy, why are you calling the police?
Simon winced.
I might just try to extricate Jack.
He left the room. Ellen stayed pinned to her seat. There was no valid excuse for her to get involved. She wondered if she should be frightened for their safety, if Saskia was about to pull out a gun or a big shiny kitchen knife. The book she was reading said that the vast majority of stalking victims weren't even physically assaulted, just mentally terrorized.
but it was still filled with horrific real-life case studies where some poor victims did end up dead. Or perhaps her mother was right and she should be frightened for her own safety. Maybe she was Saskia's target. Ellen's mother would be so cross if Ellen ended up dead.
Okay, let's everyone just calm down. It was Patrick's dad.
Ellen still hadn't properly heard Saskia's voice. She put her drink down on the Ayersrock coaster on top of a crocheted doily and wandered restlessly about the room. There was a bookshelf crammed with framed photos. She recognized one of Patrick with another woman and picked it up greedily. Could this be Saskia? Then she saw that the photo was taken in a hospital